Okay, well, my name's David Webb, and I have the honor to introduce Steve Ross to you today. Of course, Steve Ross is so well known that he's almost as well known as the LSE, so I don't need to go through an elaborate introduction since almost everybody's here because they know his work. But as is customary here, I have to tell you a little bit about Steve, just so that, as it were, we're in the tradition of this particular kind of lecture, an LSE public lecture, which is jointly done through the school and the financial markets group. Well, Steve was born in Boston. He has a BS from Caltech in physics, and then studied for a PhD in economics at Harvard University. For somebody who must have had more academic offers than probably anybody else on the planet, he actually hasn't moved around a lot in his career, having been at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, where he's a professor of economics and finance, and then moved to Yale, where he's currently Sterling Professor of Economics and Finance. One of the things that Steve has done, of course, is to bridge the academic world with the world of business, and has done this very successfully through his firm, Roll and Ross Asset Management, which manages several billion dollars worldwide. Apart from that, Steve is on the board of various companies, and in fact is in London this week for a board meeting of General Reinsurance. Steve plays tennis, sails, his wife, his children, and I'm sad to say did have a dog. And of course Steve's written an enormous amount and has influenced the way all of us think about finance. Not just his work in asset pricing, which is the stuff of certainly student lectures, but also work in corporate finance and in the economics of financial regulation. I think it's fair to say that most of us probably know Steve's work best through his work that we teach in asset pricing, where his insights into the generality of linear valuation through the arbitrage pricing model, his introduction of risk-neutral valuation as the basis for martingale representations of asset prices, and of course the much taught simplification of options pricing theory, the binomial model done jointly with Cox and Rubenstein, is very much the bread and butter of most student courses that we teach here. Steve's work, of course, in term structure has been extremely influential. That's joint work with Cox and Ingersoll. And today, there are very few people working in the financial markets that can call themselves knowledgeable and real professionals that don't understand or have taken very seriously the work of Steve Ross. So it's really a very great privilege for us to have him here today. And I leave it now to Steve to introduce his talk and tell us what it's going to be about. And I think the way we'll do it is we'll have the lecture, and then if there's some time at the end, then we'll have a few questions. Thank you very much, Steve.
Thank you very much, David. Can you all hear me in the back if I talk like this?
Can I escape, by the way?
You can escape. But before you do so, I want to clarify one thing. Lest there be any ambiguity, I not merely did I study at Harvard, I actually graduated. There seemed to be some doubt after that. I wanted to be sure. This is actually the third time I have lectured here at LSE, but the last time, the reception was different. I think it was almost 16 or 17 years ago. I recall the reception was different. First, I noticed you're all, in general, better dressed than you were then. That was one phenomenon I observed. The second was that, at the time, there was absolutely no one interested in doing finance. Or if there was an interest, it wasn't codified. So I think it's delightful to see that finance has actually become a significant part of the curriculum here. So I applaud you for what I consider to be a decision of good taste and wisdom. The talk I'm going to give bears little relationship to what it was advertised as. You could infer that, though, because I know someone pointed out to me that the spelling of skepticism about behavioral finance involved two English spellings, neither of which I would have been capable of. So I will talk about behavioral finance, and let me modify the rules a little bit. Please feel free to interrupt at any time. I'll maintain a speaker's prerogative. If the question is a little elaborate, I might tone it down or defer it to a later time. But if there's anything that you'd like clarified or any points you want to make, don't hesitate to ask. And I'll certainly leave time at the end. We have about an hour, I think, so I'll do that. And it's a little difficult with a large audience because the talk will be somewhat analytic, although I do intend to talk about broader issues here, and I will certainly deal with issues of behavioral finance. But the starting point for the talk is something that I think is becoming increasingly relevant. That's Samuelson's fallacy of large numbers. Well, it clearly is a fallacy. What happened while I was gone?
Down on the bottom left.
Well, it's on.
Got it?
Good. Yes, that works. All right, good. You can see why I left physics. To recall, Samuelson made a typically brilliant point. In fact, a lot of this lecture is just a revisit to what Samuelson did and rethinking in the modern context some of his original thoughts. Many people had a confusion about how it was financial firms, insurance companies, and banks somehow diffused risk. And the argument that was extant at the time was this was back in up until, I'd say, the early 70s. The argument at extant was that the way they did it was adding additional risk. They would add independent risk. So an auto company, an auto insurance company might take one risk and then another risk and another risk. So any company that was so foolish as to insure my son against driving would at least be sort of muted by having several thousand people like my son, all of whom were independent in their capacity to have accidents. And Samuelson pointed out that's not the way risk is diffused in a financial market. The way it happens is that a single risk is cut up amongst many individual shareholders. So the way you get to risk-neutral pricing, as it were, the way you get around risk aversion is by taking the risks of a company and having many different shareholders who share that risk. So the risk gets cut up rather than being multiplied. And he went on to say that multiplying risk didn't necessarily lower the amount of risk. And that was a misunderstanding, hence the word fallacy, a misunderstanding of the law of large numbers. Ostensibly, this all began because of an error that a colleague of his exhibited when faced with the following choice. He presented a colleague with the following gamble. He said, I'll give you a 50-50 shot at winning $200 or losing $100. And the colleague said, well, I won't take that bet, even though the colleague was more than, actually, it was E. Cary Brown. It's now been released. So I guess Brown has agreed to have his name attached to this fallacy. This is a lottery that has an expected return of $50. And you can win $200 and lose $100. But he said, I wouldn't take it. But then he said something that was really extremely interesting. He said, but I will take it if you give me the right to have 100 of them. So I won't take this one, but I would take 100 of them. Right? And he didn't say, I want the average winnings from 100. He said, give me 100 of them. And Samuelson pointed out, well, if you had 100, you could lose $10,000. He said, yes, but the odds are very low of that occurring, so I would be happy to take this. And the bulk of Samuelson's argument, the bulk of his analysis, in fact, the whole point of the paper, was to demonstrate that that wasn't necessarily a logical way to think about things. In fact, he went so far as to come close, I won't say he did, but he came close to saying it was inconsistent with von Neumann-Morgenstern expected utility theory. It was inconsistent with what we think of as rationality in these markets, rationality in behavior under uncertainty, to say I won't take this gamble, but I will take 1,000 of them or 100 of them. That wasn't consistent with expected utility theory. And he presented a theorem for us. The theorem went as follows. Let me jump ahead a little bit. Here's Samuelson's theorem. Take this out of context a little bit. If a utility function rejects some lottery like the one I gave you, at all wealth levels, so no matter how rich or poor the person is, they don't want to take this gamble, even though this is a better than fair gamble. We'll call these gambles, by the way, good bets. This is a good bet. Any bet that has a positive mean, we'll say, is a good bet. So if the utility function rejects a good bet at all levels of wealth, then he showed that it would reject any sequence of those bets, no matter how large the sequence was. And the argument is fairly straightforward. I won't go through the logic of it. I won't go through the formula. I'll just describe it to you. Suppose at the end of n minus one of these bets, you had attained a certain wealth. Maybe you'd had wins or losses, but whatever had occurred, at the end of n minus one, you have a certain wealth level. Then clearly, if you had a choice, you would reject the nth. Well, if you would reject the nth, then at n minus two, you'd reject the n minus first and the nth, and so forth. So by a simple inductive argument, if it's the case that you would reject this bet, no matter how rich or poor you are, if you reject a bet, no matter how rich or poor you are, then you will reject any sequence of those bets. Because any sequence will simply bring you to some point where you would reject the last one, and then you reject the one before that, and so forth. So that was the logic of his argument. But the argument is kind of a funny one, because it doesn't comport with the way we think these things are working. We think these things are working that, well, I'm adding more and more of these, and each one has a positive, each is a good bet. So in some sense, the probability distribution is shifting further and further to the right. The likelihood of my coming out with 100 losses in a row is pretty small. The likelihood, in fact, of my actually coming out on the negative side of 100 of these bets turns out to be 0.005. It's a 5/1,000th chance. That's the probability that you will actually, 0.005. I think it's 5/1,000ths. Doesn't matter if I'm right or wrong. It's close. About 5/1,000ths is the odds, 1 in 200, the odds that you'll be a loser in that sequence of 100 bets. It's a pretty small number. Right? And the more bets you add, the lower the likelihood that you lose. So whence this theorem? Why is it the case that this is inconsistent with expected utility theory? Or, to put it another way, this is how we think of the law of large numbers working. So I have the first distribution here, which is sort of a bet, and then I take 100 bets and take the average of them, and the distribution gets more and more peaked, and by the law of large numbers, the distribution converges very strongly, actually, converges to the average mean of this sequence. Right? But when I add these bets, that's not what I'm doing. I'm not looking at how this thing converges on average. Let's see if I can get a set here. As I add these, this might be the first bet. And then this is the second, which actually has a broader standard deviation, has a broader distribution. And this is the dotted line is the third. You know? And what's happening is the mass is all shifting over to the right there. Yeah, shifting this way for you. Mass is all shifting over that way. But it is getting more spread. And in fact, for many distributions, the tail is getting fatter. So the probability of losing below a certain amount as that amount goes down is actually rising. So there's some sort of a tension here. So maybe Samuelson is right. Maybe this intuition that because this sequence of bets has more and more probability of winning, that's not enough. It may well be the case that expected utility would always reject that. Well, this intuition shows up in several different places, and that's one of the reasons it attracted me. For those of you familiar with sort of the historical literature in finance, one of the earlier arguments was the log growth argument, where this particular debate showed up, was the log growth argument notable between Latané and Samuelson. And this argument went as follows. Latané observed that if one had a portfolio problem, where you continued to roll over your wealth, let's assume there wasn't any consumption that you withdrew, so you just rolled over your wealth, and your objective was to get as rich as possible at the end, that the right thing to do was to maximize the internal rate of growth of the portfolio, the expected internal rate of growth. And that turns out to be maximizing the log rate of growth of the portfolio. And then, in fact, that had a wonderfully powerful mathematical result that came from the law of large numbers. If you were to do that, with probability one, any other strategy that deviated from doing that, that didn't try and maximize at every period the internal rate of growth, any strategy that deviated in a significant way from that, with probability one, would give you less wealth. So Latané went on to argue that in intertemporal problems, the only thing to do was to try and maximize the internal rate of growth, or the log growth. And Samuelson pointed out that what that really meant was that you were saying you wanted the log utility function. That was equivalent to saying you wanted the log utility function. And so what he argued that what Latané was really doing was taking all of the possible utility functions that people could use to trade off return against risk and picking one, the log. And that was his rebuttal to this argument. So he said it really isn't any logical reason. I'm not sure I agree with his argument. I mean, just because the conditions that give us expected utility theory give us an entire family of functions, any one of which is an appropriate function to use, doesn't mean we might not want to apply some other qualitative properties. We might say, for example, we reject this particular utility function because while it is rational in the minimal sense of satisfying the von Neumann-Morgan axiom, Morgenstern axioms, which means the choice is transitive and so forth, what's rational in that minimum sense, there's other criteria we might wish to apply. So I didn't find his argument compelling, but I did find it sort of compellingly strange on the part of other people not to recognize that this was what the argument was about. And then we have Samuelson's fallacy of large numbers, which I just went through. Samuelson's argument has bred a literature in choice theory, and I'll give you some notable examples of it. And keep in mind what Samuelson is saying. He's saying that he has found sufficient conditions on utility functions. Well, not quite on utility functions, on the gamble and the utility function. So if you reject the gamble at every level of wealth, you'll reject any sequence of it. So he's found sufficient conditions for rejection and argued that's really what you mean by being consistent with expected utility theory. But it's a funny kind of a result because you have to know both the lottery and the utility function to decide, because that's a utility function that rejects that lottery at all levels of wealth. What you would really like to know is what utility functions have the property that if they reject a particular gamble, they'll also reject any sequence of those independently drawn. So you'd like to know what is the class of utility functions that have that property, and that's a problem notably addressed by many people, but the two I'll note are Pratt and Zeckhauser in 1987 and Kimball. Bell did a paper in 1988. Bell was concerned with the following question. It's a little tangential. I'll just go into it. It's sort of interesting, particularly interesting for being here in England. Bell is concerned with when you switch utility, when you switch choices. So what utility functions have the following property? At one wealth level, they pick gamble A over gamble B. And then as you, say, raise the wealth level, they switch and pick B over A. And they have one switch in them. So we ask, what utility functions have the property that they only allow a single switch? And the reason that's interesting is that if you go back to that literature, if you look at that paper, you'll find that the mathematics of that question are actually the same mathematics you can apply to an old controversy in capital theory, an old Cambridge controversy of when you can create a single aggregate capital stock, because that question hinges on whether or not you can switch techniques of production. So it turns out it's a very similar problem, but there are two literatures that are unaware of each other, one of which has died, the other of which is newborn. Pratt and Zeckhauser and Kimball more directly address this issue. Pratt and Zeckhauser called utility functions proper if they had that particular property that we'll call the Samuelson property. So he called a utility function proper, actually I'll call it the rejection property. A utility function is proper if whenever it rejects a gamble, it would reject two of them, independent choices of two, or three, or four, or so forth. If you reject two, you reject three and four. So they called those utility functions proper, and they found sufficient conditions on utility functions to be proper, and sort of necessary conditions, but mostly sufficient. Kimball made a contribution by pointing out that he could weaken their sufficient conditions to something that was a little more intuitive for us. So he said he proved that a utility function would be proper if it had two properties. First, if the coefficient of absolute risk aversion, the ratio of the second to the first derivative, declined with wealth increasing. And for those of you steeped in this or unsteeped in this, you know, that's sort of a nice intuitive property. It means that the richer you are, the less of an insurance premium you would accept for a fixed gamble. So if I take the ratio of the second derivative to the first derivative, it's a measure of sort of the trade-off between the curvature or concavity of the utility function and the marginal utility, the slope of it, the trade-off between return and risk. So if that curvature is declining, you're growing less risk averse as your wealth is increasing. And if you're growing less risk averse in that sense, if I give you, say, a 50-50 gamble of winning 100 or losing 100, the amount of insurance that you would pay to avoid that gamble declines as you get wealthier. And all sorts of natural behavior emerges from that. Kimball's contribution was to say utility function is standard if it has the ratio of the second derivative to the first derivative is declining and the ratio of the third derivative to the second derivative is declining. By now I'm lost. At the third derivative, I start to have problems. My intuition about this is getting shaky. I also think that this is a wonderful choice of words, proper and standard, because it implies that if it doesn't have this property, it's improper. And if it doesn't have the property, it's substandard. Not merely abnormal. I think substandard is actually the implication of not being standard in this thing. And what I'm going to argue is that that's not the way the world is, that in fact these people are looking at an extremely small niche, and that Samuelson in some sense has kind of led us astray in this regard. I'm going to skip the applications thing. I'm going to talk about behavioral finance a little bit, because this particular set of issues has been picked up by the folks in behavioral finance. Thaler and Bernardsi are notable, but others have picked it up as well. They looked at the original gamble I showed you, a 50-50 shot of winning 200 or losing 100. And they made the following observation, said, anyone would be a fool not to take that. You're just stupid not to take that, you know? And if you're, and they used an example, suppose someone professional, this was a professional, with a net worth of maybe $500,000 or $1 million, is faced with this gamble of 200 versus 100 with a 50-50 shot. This has an expected value of $50. They can lose $200. They lose $100, you know. So they're losing 100. They're going to give up a 50% chance of making 200. You know, who would be so risk averse as to do that? And they called it myopic risk aversion. They said, this is someone who about myopic losses is just hyper risk averse. Nobody should be in that position. I mean, if you add three zeros to this and ask swap shops if they would take a sequence of 1,000 of them, they say, oh yes, it would not be an issue for them. These are great bets and they're all independent. You'd be happy to take that sequence. Then they went on to argue that it's even worse than that. Anyone who actually turns down 100 of these bets in a row with a 5,000th chance of losing is a fool. That's not just risk averse, that's idiocy. Yeah. And so they say more than just being foolish, you know, it's so idiotic, it calls into question the whole notion of expected utility theory. Right? That anyone who believes expected utility theory and concludes that this is the case, that if you reject this, you ought to reject 1,000 of them, or 100 of them rather, is just being an idiot. Well, I actually am sympathetic with parts of this view. I'm certainly sympathetic with the notion that, 50-50 bets of 100 versus 200 are good bets. I'd take it. I'm sympathetic with the idea that 100 of them is not bad. I'm a little less sympathetic that 10,000 of them would be bad. You know, I mean, start to wonder, and do you really want to threaten your entire wealth by taking too many of these things? There's questions like that. But I'm somewhat sympathetic with the view. What I'm totally unsympathetic with is their solution to this. The solution to this is to jettison expected utility theory and bring us into the world of behavioral economics and behavioral finance. And this is kind of a funny place to be. This is a world where, in their example, for instance, we take away all of what we think of as ordinary rationality, and we start to use some of the terms from psychology. Framing is one of these terms. Mental calculus is another. So the kind of argument they might make is as follows. How you feel about this bet depends on where you are today. So maybe you have a very risk-averse utility function at that point of wealth you are at today. And if you lose money, you feel very badly. And if you win money, you don't feel quite so good. And if you win or if you lose, you're going to remember whether you won or lost. That's the mental calculus. You'll get to a new position, and then you might have a different attitude towards risk at that new position. And then you'll keep moving around depending on the results. I don't like this line of reasoning for several different reasons. The first reason I don't like it is that it's too easy. There's almost nothing I can't explain by using some behavioral argument about how people behave in some kind of foolish way. Once I've cut myself loose from the traditional arguments about rationality in economics, there aren't any rules anymore. So I don't like it because I said it's too easy. I don't like it because it's too hard. I have it both ways, actually. It's too hard because anyone who does finance knows how powerful it is not to do things in a path-dependent way. And this particular explanation is hyper-path-dependent. How you feel today depends on how you got there. Right? It doesn't depend on where you are. It doesn't depend on how rich you are and what the gamble is. This is bad poker. This is playing poker and saying, gee, you know, I drew two to a three card and it didn't work for the past three times. I'm not going to do it again. You know, that's a stupid thing to do. You know, going forward is a whole new game, and you ought to just examine where you are today and rationally decide how you're going to behave going forward. Now, the natural counterargument is that's fine, Professor, but people don't actually think that way. People do behave in this irrational way. That's the final reason I don't like this, and that's my major argument against behavioral finance. Not necessarily behavioral economics, but behavioral finance. The power of finance and the financial arguments we go through has nothing to do with the same kinds of logic we go through in economics. This is not the paradigm of economics. This is not demand and supply. We're not looking at the supply of some security and then averaging across all the investors what their individual demands are and determining what their particular demand for this security is. That's not what's really happening. What's really happening is that we're saying every security has nearly perfect substitutes for it. And the demand is perfectly elastic. At different prices, it'll be infinity or zero. We're saying that the real way you determine prices, certainly relative prices in financial markets, is through arbitrage, which is the most extreme form of demand and supply. So it really is not terribly critical that the average of people be particularly astute or particularly clear about these issues. What matters is that there be a handful of people who are with access to capital because they can determine the prices. I don't care if the average person makes mistakes in their portfolio choice. I do, but that's a different issue. I don't care for the purpose of determining prices in markets. I don't care if the typical person has more or less in their IRA than taxes say they should. I don't care even if closed-end funds start with premium and go to discounts. That's a certain amount of foolishness on the part of a small part of the market. I can observe all sorts of people doing foolish things, and that's interesting to study on its own. But it is not what finance is about in terms of the determination of prices. And the reason it's not is because finance is about the extremes. It says that the actual prices are determined by the far end of the distribution, not the average of the distribution. That is the distinction between finance and economics. One of the distinctions between finance and economics. So I'll come back to this issue. But I want to approach this from a somewhat different stance. The question I want to ask is the premise really correct? Is it the case that if you reject a gamble and then accept 100 of them, you're not being consistent with expected utility theory? Because that's certainly the intuition of all of this literature. I keep saying intuition because it's not the theorem. There isn't a theorem to this effect. In fact, I would read the theorems as exactly the opposite. The mathematical results are to the effect that you have to have a very special kind of a utility function to have the property that if I reject that good bet, I'll reject 100 of them in a row. Is this a question?
Yes.
Go ahead.
When you talk about accepting or rejecting 100 in a row, are you envisaging a situation where you have to say...
You have to say yes or no at the beginning.
To all 100.
Not a sequential choice. Okay. I give you 100 and you have to say yes to 100 or no to 100. You don't get to decide halfway through. Right? It actually turns out that for some cases it doesn't matter. Like the American call or the European call. It's indifferent in some cases, but in general it will be the case that it matters. All right? So I'm thinking of, I give you a choice of N today. You have to take the N or not take the N. It's a dichotomous decision made today. I want to ask, is this really inconsistent with expected utility theory? What about that wonderful intuition that the probability keeps shifting to the right and the probability of losses gets smaller and smaller? And I hope you'll leave today with one notion that actually the reverse to all this literature is correct. The proper intuition to come out with is that you should accept a long enough sequence of good bets. Rather than reject them, you should accept them. And nor is this improper or substandard, so I'm going to change the names. I hate to do this in the middle of a literature, but I think in this case, these names are so loaded, you have to do that. So here's what I'm going to be talking about. I'm going to be talking about the additive rejection property, or just the rejection property. And I'll say a utility function has the rejection property if, when it rejects a gamble, it rejects any sequence of them. All right? So if rejecting X, you reject repeated gambles in X. And that's what these people call proper or standard behavior. And I'll say that it has the acceptance property if the reverse is true. If you accept a gamble, you'll accept a sequence of gambles. Seems perfect. If the logic is, by the way, and it just this is, someone said to me when listening to a lecture on behavioral finance, they said, this is reasoning by hyperbole. So it's emphasis. You know, if the logic is that you should reject a gamble once, then it's only logical to reject it 20 times, then surely it must be if you accept it once, it's logical to accept it 20 times. I see no reason why the rejection property sort of has primacy over the acceptance property. Seems to me those are just opposite sides of the same coin. And here's the one I want to focus on, the additive eventual acceptance property. So what kinds of utility functions have the feature that if I give them a sequence of good bets, there's a long enough sequence so that they'll take them? So the probability of losses are small enough. Right? So you have a long enough sequence of these good bets, you will take them. So what are the classes of utility functions that have these? Now, it's clear these aren't necessarily orthogonal classes. They're not necessarily disjoint from each other. So if a utility function has the rejection property, then it doesn't have the eventual acceptance property, right? If it would reject any sequence, then it's clearly there's not going to be a large enough sequence that it would accept. But the acceptance property sort of sits in the middle there. It could have it could have overlap with both of the others. Right? Well, let's start out with, we've done Samuelson's theorem. Let's start out with a simple theorem. I'm going to start out with actually quite a powerful theorem here, one that will be familiar to you all. There is one case where it's clear that no matter what the wealth level is, there's a simple answer to that. The only utility function that has the property that it accepts or rejects all the same gambles, no matter how rich or poor the individual is the exponential utility function. Okay? And that's because it has constant absolute risk aversion. So no matter where the wealth level is, this particular utility function has exactly the same attitude. So it's actually an example of something that satisfies Samuelson's theorem, independent of the gamble. Whatever gamble I present you with, if this is your utility function and your objective is to maximize expected utility, whatever gamble I present you with, if you choose to reject it, you'll reject any number of them. And if you accept it, you'll accept any number of them. This has the general acceptance property and it has the general rejection property. It has both those properties. It does not have the eventual acceptance property. Right? It won't reject and then eventually, a good bet could be rejected, and if it's rejected once, it gets rejected all the time. An easy way to see that is that if I take the expectation of e to the minus ax, that's a number. All right? And suppose I'm comparing a wealth level of zero, so I sit here with wealth of zero today, well, my utility function with a wealth of zero is minus one. e to the 0 is 1, so that's minus 1. And then if I take a gimbal and I reject it, then it has an expected utility of less than minus 1, say minus 2. And if I have 100 of them, it'll be minus 2 to the 100. It's still less than minus 1. And if I accept it, it has a utility level of minus a half. So minus a half to the 100th will be close to 0, and that'll be better than minus 1. So it accepts continuous or it rejects continuous sequences of these. Right? But it never changes its mind. And it turns out this is the only utility function that has that property. Or more precisely, no, I have to be a little more careful about this. This is the only utility function that accepts or rejects the same gambles at all levels of wealth. Well, the key to this, and I don't know quite how much mathematics to do. This is an odd talk because I like the mathematics, but I realize most audiences don't. I'll do what I like. You'll see, I'll try and walk through some of it. The key tool here is the Chebyshev inequality. And the Chebyshev inequality captures that notion of the distribution spreading. What it says is that the probability that the absolute value of a gamble X exceeds epsilon, and X is mean 0 here. I'm taking a gamble with a mean of 0. The probability is actually less than the variance divided by epsilon squared. So as epsilon gets larger and larger, so I'm looking at a distribution, I'm saying, what's the probability it's in the tails? Probability it's in the tails is going as 1 over how far out I am squared. And the 1, the constant in the thing, is the variance. So the bigger the variance of the distribution, the more likely it is in the tails. That goes linear with the variance. And it turns out that the probability of being in the tails goes as 1 over the tail squared, 1 over epsilon. So keep in your mind a picture of a distribution, a bell curve, with an epsilon. And I say, what's the chance I'm outside that epsilon? I'm bigger than epsilon, rejecting above that or accepting below a certain level. And that goes as 1 over epsilon squared. This is a very useful inequality. It turns out to be the only inequality we know in this literature. That seems harsh, but it's actually close to true. Variants of the Chebyshev inequality, the only ones I've ever been able to find, and I spent a lot of time looking in the literature about large deviations. That's what we're talking about. We have a random walk. This, by the way, lest you think that this is a problem only of interest to academics, this is exactly what we're talking about in the financial industry when we talk about regulating firms, for example, using value at risk. We're asking the question, where can they go? What will happen to their wealth level if their wealth level adds up as a random walk? And we're asking, how do they feel about that? So you're getting higher and higher distributions, more and more variance, but higher means. And you say, how should I control that? That's the essence of what we're thinking about here. That's one of the reasons this isn't actually a modern day interesting problem. Well, if I take a partial sum, if I take n of these, if mu is the standard deviation, mu is the expected return on any gamble. In my original case, it's $50. So n times 50 is what kind of an expected return I get for n of them. And epsilon of n just stands for the sum of the epsilon i's, the random epsilons I add. All right? It's an unfortunate choice of notation because this epsilon is different than that epsilon. I apologize. It's only when it's blowing up on a large screen that you realize how unfortunate the choice is. When you're writing it, you don't realize at the time. Those are different epsilons. Okay? The theory of large deviations, which is the theory of random walks and how far away they can get from sort of their average, in this case mu n, is not a very well understood theory. We know some results about this. We don't know as many as we would like. And as I said, the primary tool is a form of Chebyshev's inequality. But we can use Chebyshev's inequality to prove the following theorem. Well, let me ask you, before I put the theorem, let me show you a picture of the theorem. Here's the theorem I want to prove. The dotted line represents one bet, and the large line, this bell curve here, represents five bets. All right, I just drew it with one bet and five bets. The utility function is this linear utility function. So it loses down here and it gains up here. And by the way, I'm letting everything extend to minus infinity here. That isn't a problem, and we'll deal with that later if that is an issue. If you're concerned about how can you have utility functions over wealth that's negative, don't worry, we'll deal with that. If the utility function has this form, then it turns out that even though the distribution is spreading, so even though the mass is increasing here, the expected utility contribution from this negative part isn't growing very fast. In fact, it's bounded. And that comes from Chebyshev's inequality. The probability distribution here is going down as 1 over how far away I am from the origin, 1 over epsilon squared. And this is going down linearly as epsilon. So when you take the expectation over those two, you get something that's actually constant. Right? So in fact, this part here, the mass is spreading to the right. The probability of being above the origin is getting larger and larger. In fact, the probability of being above any particular point is getting larger and larger. And since this utility function is linear and non-satiated, it gives an infinite expected utility contribution over here, a bounded one over here. And this condition is sufficient for Samuelson's fallacy not to be a fallacy. Or, to make the thing very formal, a sufficient condition for a utility function to have the eventual acceptance property, in other words, to be willing to accept a long enough sequence of good bets, is that it be unbounded from above. Now, all my utility functions are monotone and concave, by the way. So, in fact, this is actually a stronger result than the one I gave you. It's unbounded from above. It could be going off with zero marginal utility. It could be, in your direction, it could be heading off like that. But as long as it's unbounded above, it's okay. And that the marginal utility be bounded from above. And that means that as it goes off in the left, I'm doing it your picture your way, as you lose wealth, the marginal utility doesn't go to minus infinity. It goes to some constant. If it goes to some constant, then that utility function is bounded above by a linear one. And the picture I gave you before is true. It's bounded above by a linear one. So how much utility you can lose in the negative part is bounded above. And the proof really just amounts to, in fact, I won't go through the proof. The proof is just an analytic description of exactly that phenomenon, where you take the expected utility, break the integral into two parts, look at the contribution from the negative and the contribution from the positive, and show that the contribution from the positive is going off unbounded, contribution from the negative is bounded from below. So eventually the utility can get arbitrarily high and will be above whatever initial utility you started with. So eventually it's going to be the case that you will accept this sequence of gambles. That's a very broad class of utility functions. If you're worried that utility functions can't be bounded, here's another case that works. Here I've thrown away concavity. I have a utility function that's bounded above and bounded below, as long as it's not satiated above. It's bounded above and bounded below. And then as I add more and more of these gambles, it turns out you always accept. Enough of these you'll accept. Even if you reject the first 500, there'll be a number large enough so you'll accept them. And then thereafter you'll accept. Why? Well, the probability of being in this region is zero. It's going to zero as the number of bets gets larger. Probability of being up here is going to one. And the utility you get up there is higher than the utility you lose down here. What is improper or proper about this? This seems to be perfectly proper. In fact, we have a theory that says if we really do extend utility functions, they have to be bounded above and below. So this proves that for any utility function bounded above and below, there is no fallacy. You would accept a long enough sequence of good bets. We also have a theorem that says if the utility function doesn't go to minus infinity faster than a line, you'd accept them. Well, we actually have one more powerful result than that. We have from a generalization of the Chebyshev inequality the following result, which is the most significant one I have, which compounds all of the others. This is not only sufficient, it's necessary. A necessary and sufficient condition on utility functions to have the eventual acceptance property, which is to say that, and I'll go through the details of it, a necessary and sufficient condition for it to be the case that if I give you a long enough sequence of good bets, you'll take it. Is it the utility function to have the property that marginal utility not go to infinity exponentially? As long as the marginal utility, when you lose wealth, doesn't become infinitely bad exponentially, you'll always accept a long enough sequence of good bets. And the caveat here is that the variables have to satisfy the condition of lemma 1. The lemma 1 condition are only that the random variables have a moment generating function. That's the necessary. So as long as I confine myself to random variables that have a moment generating function, indeed have a moment generating function somewhere on the line, that's sufficient for this theorem to be true. So let's sort of summarize where we are. This property of accepting a bet, or more precisely, this property that you reject a good bet, but you accept a long enough sequence of them. Like an insurance company that says, well, I'll reject that insurance bet, and I'll reject that one, I'll reject, but if you give me 1,000 of them, I'll accept them. That's not antithetical to expected utility theory. I would argue it is the most generally consistent behavior with expected utility theory. Because not to behave in that fashion is to have a utility function that is different from this. And to have one that's different from this would strike me as highly pathological. To have a utility function that is so averse to losses that its marginal utility is going to infinity faster than exponential, well, that's very, very fast. You know, I think that that's too fast. So I can give the same emphasis that anyone else can. I can say it is improper not to do this. So I want to convince you that improper is proper and substandard is standard, and that standard and proper are abnormal and improper. Right? And this is the heart of the result that we have. Let me go back now. I'll conclude briefly with some contributions to the other literatures. There are a lot more examples and things in the paper, but here I think what's interesting is more the mathematics. Let's do this one. Show you how you really, this is the sort of stuff where you have to know a lot about this to like it. I don't know if you like this. A is the coefficient of absolute risk aversion, a necessary condition for a utility function to have this rejection property, i.e. to be proper. So if it rejects one gamble, it will reject a sequence. A necessary condition is that its A, which is its coefficient of absolute risk aversion, has to be declining, and it has to be convex. Right? Declining, but at an increasing rate. Right? Decreasing rate, declining, but decreasing. And a sufficient condition is that it's declining. And I guess I misspoke. The sufficient condition is that it's declining, but it's declining at a decreasing rate. A necessary condition is declining at a decreasing rate, but actually that rate has to be bigger than A prime A, first derivative times the function itself. Well, the thing I like about this is that you can simplify a lot of the proofs in this previous literature by recognizing that this is a terrible differential equation. It's an explosive equation. You know, this drives the coefficient of absolute risk aversion. If it doesn't have all the properties you want, it drives the coefficient of absolute risk aversion to infinity at a finite wealth level. So there's reasons to reject that. So this turns out to be necessary and sufficient. And I guess I'll end with one further result and leave quiet for questions. Going back to the first result I started with after Samuelson, if you really do like your utility functions to be proper and standard, I would argue two things. First, to be proper and standard, or either one, that means that if you reject a gamble, you reject a sequence. I think you should also like your utility functions to be really proper and really standard, which is to say that if you accept something, you'll accept a lot of them. If you want both those properties to hold, the only thing is the exponential. So we're back in this awkward world where the exponential utility function is the only thing that works. Okay. Let me conclude with one comment about where I'd like to, what I've been looking at. I've been looking at what I described to you, financial regulation and value at risk. Because it turns out that people who choose, or firms that choose a value at risk level, have an implicit utility function. You can infer the utility function they have from the value at risk level they hate. And from that, you can ask how they feel about the other lotteries that they're doing. And you ask very general questions about what kind of behavior do you expect such firms to engage in. Right now, we have a mode of financial regulation that is sort of a tool without a rationale. It's like a hammer without a nail. I mean, we have this thing called value at risk, and we like it because it seems better than standard deviation. It's not better than standard deviation. It's different. It's not better. It's just different. If you like the value at risk as a technique for managing your portfolio, for managing your risks, and I recognize that most good firms use it as just one of many different techniques, but implicit in choosing a value at risk level is actually a particular utility function. And I suspect that if you were to look closely at what the implications of that were, you would like it a lot less than the value at risk level you chose. Not to mention the fact that people are really confused about what value at risk is. So I will end on that and say, I hope you've come away with the notion that proper is improper and standard is substandard and vice versa. Why don't you ask questions?
I think that if we've got anybody in the room who sees themselves as a De Bont and Thaler fan, perhaps they should speak now or remain forever silent. But have we any questions?
Yes.
Yeah, Lucien.
Could I make one remark which, of course, you're aware of that you haven't mentioned, which is that your general conclusion is that it was very different, which makes the problem of scandals ruin in the account. And without going further into that, I'd like to mention that's not very well known paper by Maurice Allen, where he considers what is the fair entry fee to playing and he distinguishes two types of that. The first case where you vary the wealth which people in court possess, and of course their bankruptcy puts an end to the game. And secondly, sequences, and this was my previous question, sequences where debts are settled after each player of the game, and sequences where you can hold out to the end and so take advantage of the law of large numbers.
Yes.
Now, I know people's vote is rather extreme, but if we're talking about financial regulation and sovereignty,
I'm aware of Allais' paper. I've read Allais' paper. That's a wonderful little paper. I point out to you that it's a funny paper from the perspective of the literature because a lot of it is a translation of what was done in the probability literature, where instead of using utilities, what you used was just sort of payoffs. So since it's all linear utility, it's just payoffs that happen to be concave in the payoff space. The gambler's ruin problem is very similar to the problem we face with these financial regulation issues. Major distinction is that in financial regulation, you're actually worried about, or they claim to be worried about, systemic risk, as opposed to the individual risk of the gambler. I am sympathetic with and like the approach in the gambler's ruin thing. It's a natural direction to take my research, but I don't think I'll go that way. Okay? It is natural. There's other things I'm more interested in than that at this stage. Okay.
Are there other questions?
No one wants to defend behavioral finance. Wonderful. Good. Who's speaking? Raise your hand. I can't. Oh, there you are. That's how I was going to. So in the behavioral fund, you mean the explanation of the behavioral fund? Okay.
Back in a vacuum where he operates completely in a vacuum and forget that when people use value at risk, they're using it properly, they actually feel so. In a business cycle, and they interpret those VAR numbers, and you're quite right, there is an implicit utility function in the way in which software is conditioned to account for that business cycle in which they do it. Of course, they have to do the cycle, but for sure, they have countervailing effects of business premium, not just financial institutions, but also individuals. Therefore, this property, which is quite beautiful in some respects, is not natural to describe the kind of financial markets which you basically would like to describe with these graphs.
Let's go back. Let's go over two parts of that. The first issue is, do risk premia vary intertemporally? And do they vary stochastically in some appropriate way? And I think that literature, there's sort of two parts to that aspect as well. One is, yes, they do. They appear to vary intertemporally, although it appears to be extremely difficult to measure how they do vary. In either the small or the large, we have a very difficult time getting good statistical handles on the movement of risk premium. That doesn't mean they don't move. It's just hard to find it.
I think it's plenty of evidence in the literature.
No, but let me keep, it's my turn now. The second thing is, there is this, in behavioral finance, the risk premium comes in mostly on the side of trying to explain why they're so high. So we have the risk premium puzzle. And one of the reasons people invoke time-varying risk premium is to argue that the average can be high while it's still rational for people to have periods of time when they think it's low and periods of time when they think it's very high. So let me spend just a moment of time on whether the risk premium is too high. I actually don't believe it's too high. My personal view is it's absolutely faulty reading of the statistical literature. And now it's actually becoming malevolent, because we have this long list of financial advisors I'm encountering now who are really, now let me keep going, who are advocating that you should only invest in stocks because they always outperform bonds. So let me go back to the statistics. The reason the statistics is so difficult is that it's extremely difficult to measure a mean, and we need more years than we actually have. And when we try and go backwards in time, we select the data. And when we select the data, we have a survivorship bias issue, all of which would argue for a higher risk premium. Now, the second question is, can you really resolve all these issues of behavior at the VAR level with firms that use VAR by changing expectations of the risk premium? I don't believe that that's the case at all. I see no reason for it. So much of what appears to be a changing risk premium is simply a change in your attitudes towards risk as your wealth changes, or a change in your attitudes towards risk as the market performs in one way or another. It's almost impossible at a statistical level to distinguish that from simply saying, well, people have exactly the same wealth and they have a different risk premium. I can't tell the difference between these two. And it's much more comfortable for me to use the artillery of option pricing theory and just say, I ought to have a VAR that depends upon my wealth level, simply because where I am is a function of, you know, how I feel about it is a function of how rich I am, because my utility function is different, you know, my position on my utility function is different. To try and say the reason I should change my VAR is because I think I'm in a different part of the business cycle, I think that's going back to areas that we never were productive with in the first place. And we don't know anything about business cycles anyway, and to bring that stuff into finance, my God, I mean, we've done so well without it, please, you know.
Briefly, yeah.
It's kind of funny that we know what we're doing. There are some of these sort of economic things that aren't natural. The paper by Fisher Black about parity utility functions, which basically distinguishes between the round utility functions and the direct utility functions, explains if you actually statistically, or someone who statistically tested it, of course you find plenty of problems with the noise of family data, but all the rest will never ever be happy. But the point is very simple.
Oh, I agree with that. I think exponential, I agree. I think exponential utility functions are terrible. That's part of my point. The last thing I would have, I mean, I wanted to close my argument by saying, how could you possibly believe that the only proper utility function is an exponential when I think it's one of the paramount improper ones? I certainly agree with that. It turns out, by the way, I could convince you that some of these power functions aren't as desirable as you might like. Because some of these power functions have these very odd properties. Here's an example of a power function. If your power utility function has a risk aversion level of a half, or rather two in this case, so the power case is minus one. So if it has a risk aversion of two, it turns out, which seems reasonable, a relative risk aversion of two, it turns out that if you have a wealth, I have an example of a paper, if you have a wealth of about $25,000 and I give you a 50-50 shot of losing $20,000 or making another $20,000, you pay $18,000 to avoid it. That seems bizarre to me. You know? You're worth $25,000. If you lose the gamble, you'll have $5,000. So you're prepared to have $7,000 for sure and give up a 50-50 shot of making $45,000? That seems crazy to me. So that seems, I'll follow the behavioralists and say, who does that? You know, so I think relative risk aversion utility function, the power functions, aren't all that cracked up to be either. But let me say one other point on this business of derived utility functions. The only reason I can make this argument about firms is that it's a derived utility function. In fact, we don't even believe firms have utility functions. We're looking at the derived utility function for them, which is a linear valuation conditional on the constraints of running the firm. Other questions?
Do we have somebody who's prepared to say they've not been persuaded?
Don't push.
Would like
it's
to
okay.
defend behavioral finance?
Thank you.
Well, either they were all persuaded at the beginning.
I think they were all persuaded before I came in.
Very admirably. Well, thank you very much, Steve, for
an
interesting stimulating lecture.